Since 1937, Ducks Unlimited has been the leader in waterfowl conservation, with over 16 million acres of habitat conserved. DU supporters and volunteers have led the charge to fill the skies with waterfowl, today, tomorrow, and forever. You too can play a role in leaving a legacy for the future of waterfowl hunting. To find an event near you or to join our volunteer team, go to www.ducks.org/volunteer. Ducks Unlimited. Conservation for a continent.
Welcome to the Standard Sportsman Podcast. The show features trending topics, touching all aspects of duck and goose hunting in an effort to motivate others to leave the resource better than they found it. Hosts Cason Short and Brent Birch are lifelong Arkansas hunter conservationists, delivering thought-provoking discussions with engaging guests before, during, and after duck season. Thanks for spending time with us today. Now let's jump into today's show with the guys.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Standard Sportsman. This is Cason Short, joined as always with my co-host Brent Birch. Brent, what's going on in your world today?
Man, real deal springtime, and I guess getting ready for this eclipse. You know, we've been talking about it for a year or whatever, and now it's finally here. I'm a little skeptical on these numbers they think we're going to get, but numbers as far as people, not ducks this time.
Yeah, tourist. It's all tourism.
Yeah. So, that's pretty much, that's what's going on.
The Standard Sportsman Podcast is brought to you by the following sponsors. Waterfowl hunters deserve to have a set of waders that can excel year in and year out throughout the duration of the season. So Sitka Gear set out to build the best pair of waders ever. Constructed from Gore-Tex Pro Laminate, the face fabric offers added durability and is breathable in active working conditions while completely sealing out the elements. Importantly, they proudly stand behind all of their Delta Zip wader features with their 100% serviceable guarantee. And I'm speaking from experience as I have sent my original pair of Sitka waders from the 2018 season back twice without a hiccup. Engineered to outwork, outlast, and outhunt everything else in the market, the Delta Zip Wader from Sitka Gear is the gold standard for reliability. The Chatham Jacket from Tom Beckby features a durable, weatherproof 8-ounce wax shelter cloth shell that develops a great-looking patina with use. I've actually worn this jacket the last couple of seasons and appreciate the shorter cut to it, so it fits great inside my waders. It's also a really good weight for most Arkansas days of field. So if you'd like to mix a little vintage look with your technical gear waders, this is the jacket. You can find the jacket online at tombeckby.com. You can also find it in their brick and mortar locations in Wilson, Arkansas, Birmingham, Alabama, and the new store in Oxford, Mississippi.
Are you excited about the eclipse?
I don't know if I'd mark myself as excited. I mean, it'll be cool to see. Obviously, it's something that doesn't happen every day. Sorry. We've got a place over at Lake Hamilton, Hot Springs, and I think we're going to go over there and watch it because you can get out on the lake and
see
what we can see. I've heard some forecasts say it's going to be cloudy. I've heard other ones say it's going to be thunderstorms. I've heard others say it's looking like it might clear. So, I mean, who knows?
Kind of on the fence about the weather. I think it's pretty neat. I've seen some partial eclipses before that were underwhelming. But I guess to be in totality, like the majority of the state of Arkansas is, it's pretty neat not to have to travel to go see it. I don't know that I would load up and go 3-4 hours away to go watch one, but it won't take much out of my day to view it. So
I'll be all 4 minutes. I think in Hot Springs, we're getting 4 minutes.
Yeah. So technically we are, I guess our farm is right outside of totality. I can drive about 10 minutes and get 90 seconds of totality or go a little bit further. So we'll see how far we migrate that day. But I don't know. It'll be kind of neat. Not something you see every day. So I'm sure my kids will enjoy it.
Yeah. And see what the wildlife does. Some people say it won't be anything. They'll think it's like a big cloud. And some people say, they might do some weird stuff. So. Who knows?
Yeah. So that's one reason I kind of don't really want to leave the farm. We've still got some snow geese and a good number of ducks hanging around, a lot of blue wing, but I kind of want to see what they do. If there is a behavior change in waterfowl, that's probably not something I'll ever be able to witness again in my lifetime. So I kind of want to check that out. That's the nerd coming out of me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it will be. You're right. We may not, not see something like this the next time it happens. I know there's is one coming in a handful of years. Maybe we'll still be alive and kicking, but who knows if it's when ducks are still around and stuff like that. So,
yeah, I think it's what, 2044, so 20 like more that. Years.
Yeah.
Could something like different that. By then. Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know the timing of that one either. So
I don't either. But down the road, anyway.
That's
well,
right.
let's tell everybody who we've got today and jump into the show.
Yeah, of course. I've got a guy on. Everybody knows the name. Everybody knows the face, and of course the brand that he represents now, and has played a huge role in building that brand. But we've actually been, I don't know, we've talked and run to each other and all that for several years. Big help on Greenhead a handful of times. Big help on the Grand Prairie book. But actually got to hunt together for the first time this past year, filming an episode of his TV show there at Bull Sprig, which is a famous club on the Grand Prairie, kind of in those big ditch bottoms that we talk about sometimes. But today we've got John Stevens of R&T Calls on the show. So, John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm listening to y'all talk about the eclipse. I feel like I'm in totality of darkness the majority of the time, so I don't know. I don't know how excited I am about it.
Yeah, just another day. Well, I can appreciate that. I feel like that sometimes too. But yeah, so what's going on down in the Stuttgart area these days? I know I saw some stuff on social media. You took some express boat guys fishing, and looks like y'all did all right with this weather warming up like it is. I don't know if the crappie bite's on yet. I haven't heard too many people going crazy on them.
Yeah, we've I like to fish about as much as I do duck hunting. Duck hunting definitely is my first love, but I don't know. I've just grown up fishing, and my dad liked fishing, and it's something that I can do that has really nothing to do with work. So,
yeah, there you go.
I enjoy it. You know, seems like everything else that has to do with some type of hunting ties into what we do. So it's a pretty good release just to get out and do that. And man, we've got such awesome partners that we try to do film shows with them throughout the year, you know, different ones. We can't obviously do them all in one year, but this year we had Express, and we had an idea of taking two of their Bass Elite fishermen hunting and then bringing them back and us going fishing with them. You know, it's kind of a neat thing for them to do the hunting side and not have to worry about fishing, and us, you know, to go fishing and watch what they do and not have to really worry about the hunting. Because when we take guests, I still am the world's worst about, I get so worked up, feel pressure that we have to have a good hunt every time. Even though it's hunting, you know, when you have guests there, you want them to enjoy it. A lot of times you don't have any control over it, but you still get worked up over it. So it was fun to go with them and see how they, you know, I've fished that reservoir, man, since I was a kid. So I kind of know and get stuck in a rut where I'm going to go fish every time I go out there. So it was fun to see guys that do it for a living, how they approach a reservoir that they've never been to before. So that was really pretty cool.
Yeah, I bet it was good. I got a short, quick story I'll share. My older son, Reed, fished yesterday with Larry Nixon, you know, Bassmasters Classic winner and
yes,
first $1 million man. Reed had met Larry through a guy Reed works with that is neighbors with him and been friends with him a long time. And he brought him, they brought Larry spec hunting on our farm last year and had a great hunt. And so he returned the favor by taking Reed smallmouth fishing yesterday on Greer's Ferry. And so they tore him up. They had a big day. But, you know, it's pretty cool. Not every day you get to fish with a guy of that notoriety in that world.
No, that's really cool. And I'll tell you, like, when I grew up, I followed all that bass fishing a lot when I was a kid just because I enjoyed fishing. And Larry was probably my favorite fisherman at that time, besides, like, Hank Parker. But Larry, being from Arkansas, I always thought that was cool. And
yeah.
Butch got inducted into the Game and Fish Hall of Fame, I believe. Larry was there, and I was, like, all geeked out, you know, get my picture made with him and everything. So that was a cool deal. Super nice dude.
He is that. And he's been really good to Reed. And he's supposed to take him crappie fishing when the bite cranks up there on Greer's. He still lives up around there. So, you know, he can get over there pretty quick and knows when they're on them. He's, He's a fun guy to hang out with. Really good guy.
Yeah. John, did you learn anything fishing with those anglers? I know you said you fished there a lot and kind of knew.
I'll tell you this, what I learned is it's not always easy for them either. But, you know, it's, man, we, a front had come through and I think the fish had kind of turned off, but, you know, we didn't catch a lot. We probably caught 12, 15, you know, bass, a boat. They did though. I will say this. They did hook about a 9-pound bass or so and lost it at the boat. So,
oh man,
that was cool to see. And, you know, at least, you know, there's some good sized fish in there, but, yeah, I learned a little bit, man, just watching them, you know, like I said, how they approached this time of year, where they chose to fish, and, you know, how the weather played a part of it. I mean, it's a lot. We were talking in the show that we kind of filmed is kind of, that's kind of what it's about, is how that duck hunting and fishing and really any type of hunting, fishing, you know, has parallels. You know, you have natural factors and how those affect, you know, whether you're fishing or hunting. So it was pretty neat to see they kind of deal with the same things we do as, you know, as duck hunters.
Yeah, for sure. Now, was this in the same reservoir you duck hunt?
Yeah. Yeah. So like our farm, we've got, there's actually four reservoirs, but only two of them, well, I guess three of them you could fish. Only two of them we duck hunt. And the one that we fished was the bigger one. It's like about a little less than 350 acres. And it's the one on Little DeGruy. The other reservoir down that we duck hunt, we don't fish on, but there's like three little reservoirs there together, and they're all about 70 acres apiece. But it was cool because this is the one that they hunted on. So seeing it two different times of the year when the water's, you know, drawn down really low when we're duck hunting, and this time of year when it's up really high, just holding, you know, water for irrigation and stuff.
That's awesome. Yeah, I couldn't tell. You know, I've obviously seen the hunting plenty of times, you know, on a television show, but, you know, you could definitely tell you were in a reservoir, but, that's pretty cool that you can almost year round that thing.
Yeah. And, you know, we actually got it, on camera. We caught a couple of bass inside the actual blinds, you know, just cause the water gets up so high. I guess the way it's mounted up and gravel, it's a good spot that fish like to get into, but it's pretty cool to be able to shoot ducks out of that blind and catch a fish right out of the same one.
Yeah, that's super cool. Super cool. Well, you know, as we kind of get into this, because I want to talk about y'all's place and how y'all assembled all that. But why don't, you know, for people that don't know or know who you are, but don't know much about you, why don't you give us a little quick, you know, about John?
Well, man, I've grown up in Stuttgart and my dad's farm family. So, you know, being here at that age, I mean, that's one of the first things you really go out and do is duck hunting, and going through butcher's classes from duck calling. I just always had an interest in it, from going hunting with my dad. And that really kind of led me into, I guess, cause I like calls so much or like going hunting, that I had family members that would give me some of their old duck calls and I started collecting them. I always say, you know, you're, just one thing that's either, I guess, hereditary or born in you, you're a collector, you're not a collector. And usually if you're a collector of something, you collect a lot of different things. And I went through a lot of things as a kid, from comic books, baseball cards, and duck calls. Duck calls was really the one that really stuck, I guess, because it was unique and had something to do with duck hunting. And so, I started collecting calls when I was 7 or 8 years old. And that was about the time that I was getting into Butch's yearly youth clinics that he did. And for people that don't know, Chick Majors actually started that, and it'd be about a 6 weeks class that they would put on here in Stuttgart, and they'd have three different levels, like beginner, semi-advanced, and advanced. And it was in the fall, and, you know, you'd obviously enter beginners first, next year you're in semi-advanced. And about the time I was in semi-advanced, Johnny Mafus, it came to me, and I guess I was progressing a little more than the other people were. So I said something about it, maybe starting to take private lessons from Butch at a shop. And that was really my first introduction to Butch. And so I started going over there when I was, man, I want to say 10 or 11. And to get a duck on a lesson that was more geared towards the contest and start the contest calling. So that's really kind of how I got into the actual contest calling. And then, man, after just being over there, I guess watching him make calls, that's, you know, it just, I can remember at that age just thinking how cool it was to see him turn a piece of wood and to make a call out of it. And I mean, kind of say the rest is history. I mean, that's kind of cliche-ish, but that's, I mean, from that point on, I was just obsessed with duck calls and from collecting them and making them. And I remember telling my parents I wanted to make duck calls for a living. And at that time, nobody really did that for a living. You know, it was more of a hobby. Like even Butch had another job. And so, of course, that's when they said, well, you know, you got to go to college. And so did that, got a degree in landscape architecture. And my wife, Angie, we got married then and moved to Hilton Head, South Carolina, lived out there for a while and practiced landscape architecture. That was my degree. I was big into golf, too, and thought I was going to be a famous golf course designer. And after being at Hilton Head for just a little while, man, I really missed duck hunting. You know, there wasn't, I mean, there was some hunting out there, but being on Hilton Head, that just wasn't the place you wanted to be for duck hunting. And about that time is really when Butch started having heart problems and heart attacks. And he wasn't really at the point where he needed a heart transplant yet, but he had come to the realization that he was going to sell Rich and Tone. And he was talking with Hunter Specialties and I think Lohman, there was a couple other companies. And we were just sitting talking about it one day at a shop when I came home from, I think it was Christmas break. And he said, well, why don't you buy it? I just laughed. I thought, yeah, I mean, with what? You know, I hadn't been out of college that long. And living in Hilton Head wasn't the cheapest place to live in the world. And I didn't have any money. So, the more we talked about it, I started thinking, you know, it's not that far fetched of an idea. I got a degree. Angie has a degree. We didn't have any children yet. So, we could move back and try to make it work. If it didn't, we could always go back and do what our degrees were in. So we decided to try it. And still to this day, my daughter Riley is still upset that we didn't tell her that we lived in Hilton Head until she was about 10. So she said, what? Y'all lived on a beach on an island? And so that's kind of, that's how we've been through here. And or got to RIT, I guess. But as far as the contest calling, that was another big part of my life. Shoot, I started when I was 11 years old, I think. And I was trying to think of the other day. I won the Junior World in 85 and won the Champion of Champions in 2015. And again, I'm a landscape architect. I'm not a accountant, so I don't know how many years that is, but that's a lot. I don't know, it's 30 or 40 years. I think 30 years. So a big time of my life anyway has been competition duck calling. So, you know, that was always important and tied the call collecting, the call building, all that together. So, it's between that and duck hunting. I mean, I spend a majority of the year centered around something that has to do with duck hunting.
I'm sure. Yeah. Well, so tell us a little kind of the evolution of R&T, because, you know, Brent and I are local and are familiar with a lot of these stories and stuff, but for those who aren't, talk to us a little bit about kind of that transition, right? So you agree to purchase R&T. How does it go from what it was to what it is now?
Well, just starting out, you talk about Butch and his history here. He was a competition caller. He learned from Chick Major, who was, at that time, probably the most popular duck call maker, in the, I guess, 50s, 60s, early 70s here in Stuttgart. I mean, there used to be so many duck call makers in Stuttgart, a lot of very well-known ones, too, from Jake Gardner, Clyde Hancock, like I said, Chick Major, Billy Starks. There's a ton, Charles Marchand, and then the surrounding areas, even Clarendon with TaylorMade. It's real big, rich history of call makers, and that's something I hope we can get back to at some point. And there's starting to be some more come up around, start. And that's kind of one of our little I don't want to say mission statement, but one of our goals with R&T and with the Flying Duck is to try to help promote that to grow these small call makers and get people back interested in it. But so get back to it. So Butch was he learned from Chick Major, and also Butch had a uncle, Clyde Hancock, who was a famous duck call maker and world champion. So Butch had pretty good background to start, and he learned not only calling, but learned the craft of call making from Chick Majors. And he, you know, he didn't ever, I guess he helped Chick in his shop and everything and helped him with the lessons, but he never started making calls until after he won the Champion of Champions, which was in 1975. And right around that time is when Chick Major passed away. And so that's kind of when Butch felt like, you know, it was, he should start making calls. He didn't really ever want to do it while Chick was still making calls. So all that kind of worked out. And he started Rich and Tone in 1976. And he started it in a, I think in his garage, actually. I know he moved to a couple different places. And then when I guess, started going over there, he was right behind the old Max building in a little shop there. And so, yeah, so that's, you know, I bought it in 99. And it was just, you know, Butch and I in the shop. And he had another job that he did. And he would come in, oh man, maybe 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon for an hour. Then he mostly worked at night. I can just remember the first time once I started full time working there, just man, going in there, opening the doors, and I might just cut Coca-Cola all day long, just blocks. And I thought that was the greatest thing ever. You know, it's still something about kind of going out on your own and doing something that you really enjoy doing. It just is, I mean, makes it that much more special. And man, when we started, it was a little different because it wasn't just a hobby anymore. It had to be a business so that, you know, I had to pay off what I had to borrow to buy it. And that's when we just had to start looking at things as far as being a business that it hasn't always been, you know, I mean, and I didn't know anything really about retail or manufacturing and obviously Butch didn't either. So it was interesting. I remember the first time, you know, we always sold to Max, which really didn't sell to many other dealers, but we needed to open up that avenue. And Bass Pro had contacted us, Herders, which was a company at that time. And man, we didn't even know what a barcode was. You know, I said, man, you got to have your products barcoded and all this other stuff, and didn't know anything. We had to go and start, I mean, getting packaging, a computer, you know, to have our accounting system on. Trying to think of something else that was funny that we didn't know, but there was just, you know, things like that that we had no idea to do because Max was right next door. It was such an odd situation that when we would, I mean, people would come into Butch's and buy calls direct, but if we were going to sell stuff to Max, there never was a PO. There never was, I mean, we just made whatever we made and took it over there and they wrote a check for it. You know, it wasn't I mean, as much as you could take, they would write you a check for it. And so it was just, it was very interesting. But we learned a lot, you know, as far as not just manufacturing, but selling mainly. I can remember Tom Matthews, when he was started Avery, Cabela's was wanting us to start selling to them. At this time, we were selling to Max, and we weren't selling to Bass Pro either at this point. This was going to be one of the first time that we ever went to look at selling to, you know, a retailer or anything. And man, I'd never been in a meeting like that before. You know, I got dressed up and tried to look respectable and went. And back then, Cabela's was kind of like, I don't want to say the Walmart of sporting goods, but they were a big company. So it was a big deal to go to Nebraska. I flew up there and I was nervous. And I was nervous on the way up there. And then I don't know if I got the flu or what, but I had like 102 temperature, which probably was the best thing that could have happened to me at this point. And we go in there, and I really wasn't crazy about wanting to sell to them because I just didn't know if we were biting off more than we could chew as far as figuring out, you know, getting orders there on a timely fashion. Because, you know, they were a real company and they had other stores, you know, you'd ship to their warehouse and they would go to different places. So we've just never done anything like that. And with Butch's health, he was still kind of teaching me how to make calls. So he was still doing, you know, the majority. I mean, I could turn some barrels and stuff, but he would still be jigging everything out and all that. So Yeah, there was a lot of pressure, and we went into that meeting, or it was me. Butch didn't go, and I was with Tom Matthews and a guy that started Robo Duck was there. And anyway, we get in there, and I feel terrible, and I didn't really want to sell to them, and so I was just showing them this, and the guy said, you know, well, if we do this. Here's our pricing. And I looked them straight in the face and said, you know what, guys, I don't really care if we sell or not to you, you know? And the look on their face was so funny. I remember Tom Matthews said it was probably the best thing I could ever done because nobody ever told Cabela's no, you know, we were there to court them. And instead it kind of reversed it to where they were like, what do you mean that? When I said, well, I'm not really going to say, I just wanted to come see what y'all, you know, how you sold stuff. Or how this worked. And I think, like I said, I think it actually helped us because we didn't sell to them that year, but it made them really want to carry our product. And about 2 years when we were ready to do it, we didn't have any problem getting in there. And it was just a funny story because I felt terrible. Whatever I had, the flu, and I honestly did not care if I was sold anything. I just wanted to come back home. But it all worked out good. And from that, we went to Butch was – had acrylic calls starting to be turned when I bought Rich and Tone on CNC machines. He still made everything by hand wood-wise, but acrylics, he was having someone machine them all the way except for being jigged in a jig. And Coke Plastics out of Little Rock was doing that. And so after about a year or so, you know, we were paying this money to get these. And I said, man, for what we're paying, we could probably buy one of these machines. And that was about the time that we had bought the property next to the new Max location, built the R&T shop there. And Rusty Bullock was really the first employee we ever hired. And we were sitting there talking. And I said, man, as much as we're paying for these calls and we're starting to sell now, we could probably buy a CNC machine. And we talked to, you know, of course, people selling them wanted to sell you one. But we got to thinking, man, what in the world? I mean, we're not machinists. And they were like, oh, we can come set it up for you, put your program in, show you how to run it. And so we're like, all right, we go to the bank, get a loan. And a couple of weeks later, a CNC machine shows up. And man, and I tell you, we don't know anything about machining. We didn't. We went to a little week class and learned some programming. But it's pretty much, you know, trial and error of learning stuff. So after the first weekend, I was so excited to have that thing and see up there and watch it. And the guy, salesman came in, got everything set up for us, and we were running parts. Well, I wanted to go up that weekend and run some parts because I was just so excited about having it. And as soon as I went in there to the mill machine, the CNC mill that jigs out all the calls, I had hit the wrong button, and it brought the thing that holds all the calls, that we called it a tombstone, brought it all the way across at a rapid speed, broke off the saw, knocked the tombstone off the deal. So just because I was excited to go up there and work, you know, and see it run, I'm in about 2 seconds, I had messed it up and broke the saw, and man, they had to come back and set it up. But we couldn't cut out another duck call for like 2 weeks and something. So there was this learning curve, you know, that you go through that. But now I think we have, let's see, I think we have eight or nine CNC machines. And we just started out with just that one. So it's a lot different operation now.
Yeah, I could just remember as a kid going to the one that was behind the old Max, which is now a church or whatever it is, that little concrete block building. Mm-hmm. And of course, I was a little kid. I mean, I was 11. I guess the first call I got from him was like my dad and I always called them Christmas tree because they look like Christmas tree, but they were that diamond wood.
Yeah.
Yeah. Multicolored deal. And then my dad got me a clear acrylic and I still have both of them. But I can remember going in that shop and you know, anybody that's ever been around Butch, you know, he was kind of gruff and said what was on his mind and all that. And he was pretty intimidating when you're a little kid going in there, but very vivid memories of going in there and then to see where the company is now is just, it's pretty remarkable.
Well, I'll tell you, I can still remember the first time I ever went into that shop. My mom dropped me off And I had met Butch at the youth clinics, and you know, that's the impression that you got of him when you were in that clinic, is, you know, he didn't put up with much, wasn't, you know, that personable of a person. And so I walk in there, and I can remember Conan the Barbarian was playing on TV, and he's sitting in that recliner. And I bet you I sat there for 40 minutes before he even acknowledged I was in there. And the first thing he said is he just said, go in that room and start blowing. So I'd go in there and just start calling. And I don't even think he came in there and said anything. And I came out, and he said, is that all you're going to do? And I said, yeah. So after that, he said, well, what time's your mom picking you up? And I told him it was like 5 minutes, you know, from the time she's picking me up. He goes, all right, I'll see you next Saturday. Didn't even say anything about how I blew or called, you know, anything. And but I can just remember going in there and being scared to death. But I sure remember what was on that TV. It was just, to me, it was so funny.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, you know, to think about that. And then, of course, you know, when y'all built the new store and you got over there, you know, he still sat in the front window and tuned calls mm-hmm. until pretty much couldn't anymore. But I've got another story related to Butch too. My dad, he got this call about the same time, and it was the original ivory call that Butch made out of what I can't remember what the name of that material is.
Micarta.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a Western house, Micarta.
That's it. Yeah, that's it.
The Holy Grail.
Yeah. And it was pretty white, you know, when he bought it. And then, of course, it ages, you know, over time. So it kind of yellows a little bit. But my dad still blew it forever and ever. And we'd go in and get our calls tuned. And he came in there one time with that call. And Butch told him, he said, you better take that thing off your lanyard and put that thing in a safe deposit box, because that thing's worth X. I don't even remember what the dollar amount was. But and my dad did. He bought another call that day and took that one off. And he's kept it as a collector's item ever since.
Well, you know, Butch always had some crazy stories about stuff. I never know what was right, what was true, what wasn't. But he said, you know, he told us that was at Westinghouse. They don't make it anymore. But back then, he said, whoever the guy was, now this was Butch's story, that I guess invented it or had the recipe, died, took the recipe with him. I don't know if that's true or not, but I know they don't make it anymore. So. That's one of the reasons why that stuff made a really good call. Like the sound, I know a lot of competition calls, or callers, people use Micarta calls. So it's interesting that, you know, still people try to find, I mean, there's not much available anymore stock that was around somewhere, but, it's just funny that they don't make that stuff anymore. And even somebody who's tried to make it, it just doesn't come out the same. So,
yeah, you see a lot of stuff. You know, online claiming to be Westinghouse Micarta, but
yeah, and there is Micartas, but it's not mm-hmm. it's not that same stuff. You know, a lot of it is I don't know what they call it, Micarta canvas finale or something like that.
Yeah, phenolic, I think. Yeah, which still, I mean, still makes a good sound, but it's just not it's not that Westinghouse. It's not as sought after. But I mean, if I remember, and this is talking to Lewis Gibbs and I are pretty good friends. Lewis always had stories, you know, of stuff that Butch made calls out of. I want to say maybe at one point in time they turned some underground integration pipe, like laminated together and spun some out of that, I want to say. I don't know.
We actually got one in the case up here. It's a blue
yeah.
plastic looking, but it was pipe. Yeah.
That's pretty neat. That's, to me, that's some of the really cool things about kind of what you're doing, you know, with the John Stevens signature and Callapalooza, like the folk art of making duck calls. You know, the retail segment's great, and that you guys made an amazing brand, but it's kind of the creativity and the folk art that really attracts me to collecting duck calls. And I've always just kind of been enamored with it, I guess, growing up in this area.
Yeah. And you know, that's kind of, like I said, when we to kind of go back on what we were saying about it as far as the history or evolution of Richardtown, you know, and after we were here for a little while and added on to the building a couple times and added CNC machines, it was in 2016, we had a fire and we lost 2/3 of our building or more, actually. And it was from the dust collection system. this is where it started. And I was actually out of town. What we used to do is after duck season, Angie and I would, before we had children, would give ourselves as a gift a trip somewhere, you know, after duck season, just to get away for a little while. And we didn't do it for a long time after we had Reese and Riley. And so that year we were going to go to Mexico, and we got to Mexico that evening, and said, put your phone in the safe, put everything, you know, in there, not going to answer any phone calls, just enjoy it. Well, the next morning when we got up, we just got back from brunch or breakfast, I guess. I don't remember what we did that next morning, but I do remember as soon as we got back, we exercised it, right? We went and exercised and grabbed some breakfast on the way back. And you could just hear our phones blowing up. I went to take a shower, and Angie said, man, our phones are going, you know, just absolutely crazy. So I said, well, I hate it if something bad would happen. So I looked at my phone, and the first thing I saw was the shop really on fire. I was like, you know, that's probably not a good thing. So I immediately called the rustier guy ever, and man, he was all worked up, and yep, it was on fire. Actually, I think before I actually talked to him and saw it was on fire, I was getting something, and I think it was on Facebook. I saw, you know, on the news, Rich and Holmes, a duck calling facility on fire. So I talked to Rusty, and man, he was just beat up, you know, because I mean, hell, he was here while because it happened in the day, which luckily that's when it happened in the morning. And he was just all worked up about it. And, you know, I was like, man, I mean, it's no big deal. I mean, you can only do what you can do. And so we had to go through the whole thing of trying to figure out how to get back. And we were actually able to get back that night. In Stuttgart by 9 o'clock, which was kind of amazing to me. I mean, being in Mexico and being able to get back that quick, but so much for a little vacation. And let me tell you too, when you go out of the country and your place burns down, it didn't look good. Everybody talked. That was not the reason, you know, why we left town. But when we got back, man, it was, I said, is it bad? Man, he said, it's bad. And we walked through it. He was right. It was bad. So the next morning we got up there and we tried to start setting up. You know, we had people calling us, the people that come in and not restore everything, but whatever they do after fire, where they go through your product and see what you can use, you know, see what's salvageable, what's, you know, messed up. What it is. People too that with your insurance. So we had all that to deal with the next morning, which was just, I've never had to deal with anything like that, luckily, from a disaster, but learned a lot just going through that. And it was bad, man. We'd lost, I mean, we didn't have any of our manufacturing capabilities at all. Didn't really have anything. We had our whole retail front was gone. We had a little bit of warehouse left. That was it. And I just remember getting back and thinking, man, I got 18 people that are depending on me to get this show back on the road. And we didn't have to lay anybody off. We just got together. And I'll tell you, still when people ask me what the proudest moment of anything I've ever done, my proudest moment was that day, just being able to be an employer of the people that work at R&T, because it was real easy for everybody to get down. I mean, you didn't know at that point what was going to happen. We lost, you know, our whole business, basically. Weren't going to be able to make anything probably at least for 3 months, just because of getting those CNC machines would take that long to get. There was a lot of ifs, but, you know, we sat there around the table and we got some power for, I think it took a couple of days to get some power, but that's kind of how we just started, you know, shooting around like, all right, how can we make this warehouse work for what we need? How can we figure out where we can start making stuff? We would be better off renting a place, doing these things. And like I said, we just sat there and looked at this as that it was a problem, but it wasn't a total disaster. I mean, nothing says we have to build this place back exactly like we have it. You know, maybe it's an opportunity instead of a disaster or something. And so then we started, you know, brainstorming, thinking, and that's kind of how we came up with, you know, anytime you build a house, there's always things you wish you would have done different after it was built. So that's kind of the way we approached the shop and how we could do things different. And man, we ordered those little portable buildings and looked like a duck call trailer park in the back. Had just so many buildings out there that we worked out of. And those weren't that expensive. So we ran power to all those. And we got a portable building for our retail front for duck season. And everybody else just worked in that warehouse. Everything we had from making stuff when we finally got machines in to answering the phone, everybody was in that warehouse. And it took a while to get built back. We didn't open back up until 2019. So that's 3 years. And again, being in a small town, you know how everybody talks anyway. So, you know, there's all kind of talk. People wondered if we were going to build back, if, you know, we had sold, if we had done all this stuff. And main reason is because I just couldn't make up my mind what we wanted to do. And, you know, at that point, we knew we wanted to have a bigger retail front. We knew we wanted to do something that could help promote the craft of call making, call collecting, because, and actually calling, contest calling, all those things together had been important, you know, kind of been woven in the fabric of Stuttgart. And we've seen such a decline in a lot of all those. There's not that many younger guys that, which I guess I'm not a younger guy anymore, but as far as collecting calls, you know, that either they did collect some, but didn't really know the history of the older calls. And we wanted to be able to promote that. We wanted to be able to promote the craft of call making, just because, like I said, there used to be so many call makers in Stuttgart. And to me, I've been able to do and enjoy the things I have because of that. And that's an important part of Stuttgart in our area. And I would hate to see that go, because it is an expression of folk art or, you know, art. Everybody has different interpretations, just like an artist or a painter or a carver does. So I just think it's really important to our culture here in Arkansas. So we wanted to promote that. And, you know, we actually wanted to have a full museum at one point when we started. And that was going to be on the top story of our new shop, and try to make it a for real museum. And until we got we had the architects do everything, and then we got the bids back. We thought, well, that's probably not going to work. So we had to cut something out. And that was the first thing that we had. We do have a display of old calls and do that now, but that kind of had made us pull back what our original idea was. It was really cool, but really expensive. And that's kind of what led us into the, the tap room. You know, we were trying to think, well, man, what can we do to get more people in here? Not just during duck season, but during duck season, and hang out, spend more time in here. How can we get people to visit us more in the off season than just during duck season? Because we wanted these people to be here to learn about calls, to learn about the history. So we needed to be able to keep them longer, but not everybody is, you know, fired up to come look at duck calls. Some people are. So if we could get some people in and then kind of, you know, expose it to them a little at a time, instead of just shoving duck calls down their throat or shoving it in their face. And that was our idea with taproom. We were like, man, it's a craft. Craft beer is a craft, beer making. We said, man, I don't want to say everybody likes beer, but more people like beer probably duck calls. So we thought, hey, we get in here and get something different from our area, and then, you know, people drink a few beers and walk around, look at the calls, maybe walk around and watch as we're making calls. And that led to other ways that we could promote it, by having pint glasses that have different duck call makers on them. You know, we have the rotating collection of old calls, coasters, anything that we could do to put history of calls. So basically, we were making a duck call tap room, and that was our intention, and it's worked out. I mean, it's worked out well. You know, we've had a lot of people that come just for that, and I always have people when we walk up front say, man, I didn't know this about making calls, or know this about, you know, duck calls. I didn't even know there was that many duck calls there, besides the people that come to see the duck calls. That led to us having like monthly call socials. It's just been real beneficial, I think, as far as pushing that mission or that goal out to expose, you know, more people to it, and definitely bringing a more of an awareness of the craft and then collecting. And that led to Callapalooza, which is an event that's coming up here at the end of May that we started that year of our grand opening. And we wanted to try to do a festival that we said celebrates the art of call making. And it was our idea to, you know, back even back in Butch's days, it's funny, a lot of those call makers didn't like each other or didn't get along, or, you know, and I don't know where that came from, whether just one of them said he made a better call than the other one. And that was just kind of, you know, the macho thing to do. But so we wanted to open our arms and say, hey, man, if you make a call, come set up. We're not going to charge anything. We just want to create a festival or a celebration that some people can come to and be around as many different call makers, you know, learn from different call makers. And that's kind of how Callapalooza started. And man, we started that in 2019. So this spring's coming up, you know, we've added a lot of different events to it. And it's turned into a pretty neat festival that we draw a pretty good crowd for, actually. And one of the highlights of that whole event is the call makers build off. That's we pair up different call makers. And it's kind of like a call makers challenge where they're presented with different things that they have to build or different duck calls. And it's a competition and it gets judged as far as the way the call sounds and, you know, the aesthetics of it too. So it's really turned to be a cool event. I'm looking forward to it this year. And I think it's really not only helped promote the craft of call making, but the camaraderie amongst call makers.
For over 30 years, Lyle Real Estate has been connecting land investors and outdoorsmen with sellers. Whether looking to invest in an income-producing farm or recreational land, the Lyle Real Estate team has the connections and the expertise to help. They work with tracts of all sizes and specialize in agricultural, timberland, and recreational properties. New listings are hitting the market almost weekly, so head on over to their website to learn more. www.lylerealestate.com.
Yeti. From the legendary hard coolers to the new barware series, Yeti has you covered. Or check out one of my favorite new products from them, the Loadout Series Go Box. Yeti, built for the wild.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible to see, you know, just the how this has evolved into something. There's no way Chick Major or Butch would have ever saw a call company being you can call it a marketing machine, I guess. But I mean, just. And I know you've had missteps along the way. That's natural with any business. But I mean, you've done some things that I've seen fan out into the industry and seen other people replicate. You know, not a Callapalooza, but something tied to something there in the waterfowling industry and hosting a festival and then the tap room is just whoever thought of that was really ahead of their time. Because that thing is so popular, especially during the season. I mean, you got people stacked in there and, you know, just to say they were at our, I mean, you can hear, you can walk over to Max and you hear people talking we were at R&T last night and so-and-so walked in or we saw, you know, this person or that person. Cause you got country music stars that roll in there. You got anybody famous that comes to town. It's almost like become a destination. So, I mean, hats off to y'all and being creative to think you can do that in Stuttgart, Arkansas, and create this brand and this movement within the industry. It's pretty cool to see, especially the ones that could see it from where it was and where it started.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing is, I mean, we obviously had a great head start with Rich and Tone being a known brand anyway. And we've always done a good job of, I feel like, evaluating things that other industries may have done, you know, that we can apply to ourselves. And we had, like I said, we had such a good head start with being in Stuttgart and call makers and Butch and having a brand that's like that. And I think that's probably been one of the biggest things that we do here is we all enjoy it so much that it's not, I mean, work is work at times, but it's fun to see where we can do other things with calling, you know, or call making. And like I said, we get a lot of ideas from other industries too. So I don't want anybody to think, you know, we're the first person to think of this or that, because we may be the first person to apply it to what we do. But and there's a lot of things that we have come up with, you know, on our own here. That makes us smile when we see, you know, how it can go to other places. Definitely that puts a smile on your face. But you're talking about the tap room. We named it the Flying Duck. And when we first, that was a big deal trying to figure out what in the world we were going to name this thing. And up until the day, let me see, right before we had to order the sign to put behind the bar is when we finally decided. We were going to, for the longest time, call it Clyde's Corner. I was trying to think of something because it was kind of in the corner at that time of the new shop. But I wanted to do something with Clyde Hancock because some of the stories I had heard, and again, if these aren't true, I don't know who told them to me, but they make a good story anyway. But they said Clyde liked to have a good time. And, you know, he enjoyed partaking in alcohol, I guess. I don't know if it was beer or what, but anyway, he was a good call maker, good caller, and he'd like to enjoy himself. And they said back in the day, he won the world one year. Can't remember if it was around 1943 or something, but one of the years there, they used to do, you blow either a round or two rounds during the day, and you come back at night and blow the final round. Well, he was leading. I think this was after he won his first world, too. He was leading the first two rounds. And when they went over to, he didn't show up for the final round. And when they went over to his house, he was passed out from drinking and missed the contest that night. So we thought it'd be kind of a cool, somehow include, since his tie with Butch, you know, being related to Butch and everything. And just, I've always kind of just, I don't know, had a thing about Hancock duck calls. I just thought they were like one of the coolest old school duck calls from our area and just his history. So we wanted to do that. And just to me, Clyde's Corner, just there's just something about it that I just wasn't crazy about. And I kept trying to come up with something else that had to do with Hancock. And, you know, Butch's old decal, or I say old, I guess it's the only one he ever had this kind of awkward looking duck in the center of it. And yeah, there must have been a decal salesman at that time that was a standard decal, but he didn't tell anybody. So if you look, there's a bunch of calls made in that time that has that same decal. That there was a couple in Tennessee, one in South Carolina that I can remember, but all the salesman did was just change whatever verbiage was on the oval. And so there was a lot of them around, but everybody started referring to that decal as, you know, that's a flying duck, or that's a slanted lettered flying duck. Well, everybody was calling those calls and that decal Flying Duck. And I don't know if it was because of the restaurant Little Rock Flying Fish, but to me, the Flying Duck just had a natural ring to it. And that's, I mean, up until the day before we had to make our decision on what the sign was going to look like behind the bar, that's when we decided to change the name. So I think it's a good fit. I think it's a great name.
You know, it's interesting. You're talking about the fire, and I'm sitting here looking at a born on call that was in the shop when the fire happened. It came out unscathed, survived, which was it was good for me and the kid that received it. But do you think any of this stuff would have happened, or certainly would have happened in this timeline, had it not been for the fire, if you had not kind of gotten that clean slate to come back and build what you wanted?
No, and you know, I don't want this to come out sounding negative, so I don't know how to say this, but you know, I still to this day will never feel like RMT is mine. You know, I mean, just because it's just like, if I use this example all the time, that you know, a hamburger place that somebody started and it's been that way for 25 years and they sell it, automatically everybody's like, well, the hamburgers aren't even good anymore, you know, or not as good as they used to be. Are they? I mean, who knows? But that's just the natural inclination to say something, you know, like that. And I mean, Butch built Rich and Tone. I mean, that was, you know, he started and everything. So it's weird. But when the fire happened, it was kind of, because we were kind of like starting over. I think it made us feel more like we were more part of it, I guess, if mm-hmm. that makes sense.
Sure.
And so, even though we were on the other level, it was I don't want to say like a, like you were saying, being reborn, but it was a point in time to where we were kind of starting over, and it was fresh, I guess, and everything was kind of new for us because we were doing so many different things that I think it made everybody feel like they were more invested in it than what we may have been before the fire. And I don't know, to answer your question, I honestly do not think we would have anything close to what we have as far as a retail front and a tap room if it wouldn't have been for the fire. Because I think sometimes it's easy to get stuck in that rut and not see outside the box. And I mean, when your box is burned down, it's real easy to see outside the box, you know? So I think that definitely helped. But I'm also a big believer in, I mean, you know, there's a plan for all of us. I definitely think the fire must have been part of the plan, or, you know, because I believe what we're doing now is part of the plan.
Yeah. Well, I can understand what you're saying, you know, about not feeling like it's yours or whatever. I kind of have the same sentiment in regards to my grandfather's land. You know, it'll always be his no matter how long he's been gone. It's just kind of the way it was started. So I can see what you're saying there. But obviously had your fingerprint on it even before the fire. I kind of want to talk about, there's two calls specifically I want to talk about how they came to be, and then I really want to hear kind of about your signature line too. But tell us a little bit about the incarnation of the Daisy Cutter, which could be one of my all-time favorite calls of y'all's, and then obviously the Mondo.
Right. That's when Butch had Rich and Tone, he basically had the original. That was basically it. And the original still is probably, I mean, you'd have to say it's probably what Rich and Tone is the most known for as far as that's kind of our cornerstone call. I mean, when he mm-hmm. set out to build one call that he said would do it all, and that's what the original was. It was one call that could do everything from high-end hill calls all the way down to soft clucks, quacks. I mean, it could do everything. He did make another call that he just basically the same tone board, just had a quarter inch bore in it that he called at that time like a timber call, same barrel and everything. It was just quieter. But his way of thinking was, I'm going to make one call that can do everything. And that's a great idea. And he did. I mean, that call could do everything, but that call wasn't for everybody, if that makes sense. So it's like fishing lures. You know, are you trying to catch the fish or the fisherman? And I think that's when we started talking about, you know, I mean, we can make this one call, but if there's some people that just can't blow it, or, you know, or they have in their mind what they think a duck needs to sound like, or they blew double reeds, or they blew cut downs, so they blew calls different. Instead of trying to convince these people they needed to learn to make or learn to operate the original, why not just make something for them? You know, I mean, that way, you know, it's like putters and everything else. I mean, the more models you got, you're going to be able to get to different people, and everybody's going to like something different. However, duck sounds the same. Sounds different. Every person sounds different, or, you know, does things different. So that's where we started kind of thinking like, man, let's, if somebody's wanting a call that's raspier, if they want one that's, you know, quieter, whatever, let's just make some different models. And so we started with the short barrel as the first one. Timber calls were real popular at this time. They were kind of a medium to lower volume call, had a shorter barrel on it. You could do a lot of whine on it, different things like that. So or Cajun squeal, everybody has a different name for that type of, or bouncing hen. All these little things were part of the timber call. So we came out with the short barrel, but we didn't want it to be totally timberish because we wanted to kind of have our own signature sound too. So it was a quieter call. It was raspy, but it was kind of in line, I guess, more with a timber call than anything else. And I hunted it. That was when I was guiding at Russell's, and we made it. I would take one out and blow it, you know, all during that morning hunt, come back, and we would change a few things on it. And anyway, I started to get to where I wanted a call that was even louder and raspier than the short barrel. So I just basically took a short barrel, opened up the bore and the stopper a lot, and started changing the tone board a little bit just to make it a little raspier. And Man, I got that thing where it was so raspy, it would do just about whatever I wanted on it, as far as still had that wine and where you could bring it down, but it was just, I mean, super raspy, and you could put a lot of air. It almost kind of blew like a cut down, but not with that size of a reed, because you could get a lot softer on it too. And I think that was about the time of, I can't remember which, if it was in the war in Iraq or Afghanistan. Can't remember now, but there was one of them that they were dropping these big bombs that they said were the size of Volkswagens, and they were calling them daisy cutters. And so I don't know who asked me first, but said, man, that dude said, what is that? He said, that call is raspy. He said, how do you describe that? I said, man, it sounds like whoever's hearing when that daisy cutter hits the ground, that bomb, you know, talking about how loud and just nasty it'd be. And that's kind of where the daisy cutter kind of came out with, really, or came up from.
Well, that's cool. And it's been interesting. Again, that's one of my favorites. And I've got one of the original, John Stevens signature there.
Yeah, I guess actually that's what we did first. Actually, the first daisy cutter wasn't called a daisy cutter. It was I just put my name on it. It was going to be like a John Stevens signature short barrel, basically, because it was what I had taken to the woods at Russell's, you know, okay, and modified a short barrel to make it to where I do that. And then I don't know if the first one just had my signature on it. I really can't remember now, or if it had the skull. But not long after that is when somebody was asking us to describe the sound. And that's when we came up with the name Daisy Cutter. And of course, we wanted something that was totally different, because the sound was different than original. So we said, well, man, what about? And this is something I wish I would have trademarked, because I see it everywhere now. There's always little things like that you wish you'd have done different. But we were the first person to ever use a skull and crossbones of a duck on anything. We had that human skull on the first few daisy cutters. Mm-hmm. And then I had my friend draw up. I can't remember if Blake did the first one. I was thinking Pat Murillo may have done the first duck skull with crossbones on it. And, man, I'd give him anything if we'd had that trademark, because I see people use that all over the place now, different variations of it. But so that was kind of the logo behind the daisy cutter, because it was so different.
Yeah, it's been neat to see just kind of how that tone board has evolved over the years, you know, from some of the sought after saw cut tone boards to where it is now, but certainly one of my favorites. And I know our buddy Jim was pretty involved in the Mondo. Tell us a little bit about that. That's, you know, kind of stepping out of the norm of these typical, you know, J-frame calls. What inspired and what led into the production of that call?
Well, man, cut down Olts have been used for forever. Probably since ever since Olt actually started making them. And they just, you know, that was a call that was it was made out of Bakelite, but like a molded type call. And they weren't that expensive. And especially now in the South, people were getting them and wanting to use them more for breaking high ducks and, you know, get more volume out of them. So they were buying these calls and modifying them, you know, as far as cutting their tone boards down more to get more volume, more rasp out of them. Some of them opened up the mouthpiece a little bit to be able to put more air in them. And so there's a whole history and culture just behind the cut down. But there really wasn't at that time, and I may be wrong, so if I'm wrong, I hope it don't hurt anybody's feelings. But I know there was people that were still cutting down Olts, and there may have been some type of molded calls that were, I can't really remember, that were modeled after the Olt that people were doing. But I think we were up there, if we weren't the first. I know we were the first people to figure out how to get that bore. And when I say that, the tone channel in an Olt and the way it's bored out had something, I'm guessing, in the mold, that the way they pulled the call out, but that's where you hear the term keyhole. It had like a keyhole cut in the back of the insert, and the way the where we call it the drill hole, it wasn't a drill hole, but it was a tone channel that went through there, and it kind of beveled and came up. And trying to figure out how to replicate that on a CNC machine, and I just had the idea, when, you know, we'd make whatever and get the tone boards exactly the same like Jim wanted them, and from what the ones that he had either cut down or got cut down, you know, from, I think there were ones he cut down. Anyway, we could replicate that, but we couldn't get the sound because we didn't have anything that could produce a keyhole inside there. And I got to thinking that, man, there's no way it could be a keyhole that makes that sound. And it can't be that tone channel the way it's shaped in there. It's got to be the way the air is going through it. And that would have to be the volume as far in the area, you know. So if you could get that same, just like a pipe, the pressure of air, you know, or figure out, I guess I'm not smart enough to be able to figure out what kind of, what would you call it? Not square footage, but figure out the volume that goes. And I say volume, not sound wise, but the area cavity inside there, you know, that those dimensions somehow, then we could figure out probably how to produce it. So we didn't go so much by the shape. We just started trying to take out what we felt was the same amount of material inside there as what it was cut down. And now, man, there is some people that make some keyhole calls, but I think you talk to the majority of most people that make cut down style calls, it's not so much the shape of that keyhole. And I'm not saying they may or may not sound different, but I think where people started figuring out how to manufacture that cut down sound was just getting that bore. And we drilled a hole through it and then backboard it to get basically the same area or space that was in a cut down oak. So that's kind of how they started. And I would have to say there's no doubt Daisy Cutter and Mondo have been the two biggest calls that we have produced, you know, since the original. And there's different variations of cut downs because same deal, you know, different people like different things, different people would cut them down. So we have, you know, we have ones with different tone boards that are geared to a little more different calling style. So it's really opened up a whole different, I guess, group of people, you know, buying our calls because they're the people that's all they like is cut down. We never really had anything to offer them. So it's been pretty cool to see that grow and something that we had a party and be a pretty, you know, pretty big product, not just for us, but really the whole industry as a whole. Right now, cut down calls are a pretty big deal.
That's an understatement.
Yeah.
It's even nuts how many were being made that look exactly like an old.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, I guess to each his own.
Yeah, I don't mind that so much. And we made one that was pretty close to one, but I think that's part of the draw to, I mean, definitely it's the sound, but I think part of it is that nostalgia, I guess, of an old. So, you know, since you can't buy olds anymore, I think that's just, you know, it's kind of like a wax coat. Everybody, there's different companies make wax coat, but a wax coat is a wax coat. So,
yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
Kind of deal.
That makes sense. Well, all right. So we talked about all these R&T calls, but I mean, some of the cool stuff you've really, and speaking of nostalgia, you know, your personal line of calls that you've tried to pay some respect back to some old call makers and all that. So maybe kind of talk on that just a little bit.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny because when I mentioned earlier, when we bought R&T, we had to figure out a way to make it a business. So that's where we, you know, we got CNC machines here and we make calls the way we do now. But I've always liked turning calls, making calls by hand. I mean, that's what got me into all this is watching Butch make calls. So it's kind of cool now. It's kind of, I won't say come back full circle, but I guess it has, you know, I get to still do that a little bit and at the same time still have a business. So that's been a lot of fun. But the thing that's cool is I've had a lot of time to think about it too over the years, just with Rich and Tone and everything from, you know, my logo, which is a duck, but it's got my initials. It's made up of my initials, JDS, if you look at it. Mm-hmm. And then from the first duck call model that I had drawn, I guess I draw all my ideas from older calls. And it's not just older calls. It can be anything that I see that I may take some of the design elements from the way that they look. But I thought it would be a really cool idea to I was always fascinated or how to draw the calls that had some kind of wrapping on them, cord wrapping or old string and anything like that. They just look cool to me. And that's, man, I'm drawn to that when I collect calls and find old calls. It could be that or metal wrapped around them. It just made them look cool. And the reason why they did it is if they didn't have a brass band or something, you know, they'd wrap cord around it or something to keep the wood tight so that if it did crack, didn't leak air, or, you know, hopefully bound together like that, it wouldn't crack. And so that's where I kind of thought, you know, I'm going to try to incorporate that into all my designs. And that's actually kind of become a signature of it. There wasn't really anybody these days doing that. And man, you see a lot of them now, which is not a bad thing, especially if they can, because I'm not the person that invented wrapping a duck call, but so I don't want to think that I'm taking claim for that. And I just think I've put my own twist on it. So, you know, I'm definitely nothing wrong with anybody that's wanting to wrap it. Just hopefully they put their own little twist on everything. And that's kind of the way I was wanting to do calls is I wanted to pick different influences from other call makers, things I liked about their calls. Being a call collector, you look at them all the time and you obviously like them because you collect them. So I thought if there's a way I could take a few elements and kind of put my twist on them and also educate people about those call makers through those calls by naming them a name, or I have this little flyer that goes in with each call that talks about the different design elements of each call and then where those influences came from and what call makers. So that's another way that, of educating people about some of these call makers. But so that's kind of, you know, how I started, and I wanted to do it obviously all by hand. I guess I do use my degree a little bit. I draw, and I've done this even with Rich and Tone, but any call we come out with, I sketch it out and I sketch it out to scale. And, that helps me, you know, see how things look before I actually turn one. So that's a big help. And, but yeah, all my calls from the improved call, which that's a funny one because that's the very first call that I guess designed for the JS calls. And, I'd actually kind of had an idea from, Charles Grubbs, who's one of the first call makers. I wanted to do something to kind of honor him. He's from Illinois back in the late 1800s. And so one day in church, I was drawing on my bulletin and I came up with that design. And I said, after church, I showed Andy, I said, I think it's going to be my first call I make. I'm going to call it the improved call because his model, he had an improved Illinois River model, I think was the name of it. And I said, what are you thinking about? She said, I think you should have been paying a little more attention in church. She was probably right on that. But I saved that church bulletin. I've got that on it. But it was so different that it's also, they've come up with a nickname. I don't know if it was, I think it was even me or Blake. We call it the weirdo because it looks so weird. And so anyway, that's kind of how that call started. But yeah, I got different, you know, all my calls are named something that are either from an older call maker or definitely influenced by it. And I think the same thing. I think it has exposed a lot of people to some of these older call makers that they wouldn't have known, you know. And I don't want to make replicas of older calls. I don't want to do that. I don't want to make, you know, anything that looks exactly like one. I just want them to be influenced by them. And like I said, kind of put my own twist on it. So it's been fun. And now when you come in Rich and Tone, you know, you can see both sides. You see how we make them at R&T, and you can see how, you know, they were made by hand through my shop. And that's another thing that I really haven't made that many of my calls. And a lot of people don't understand. I didn't want to do it starting out. I didn't want to take orders. I just wanted to make calls when I had time and then either take them to a show. That's really what I wanted to do, is be able to take them to some duck call shows and stuff to maybe attract people to come to those shows. You know, and help again with promoting call shows. But I did start taking some orders during some of the Callpalooza events, and still haven't got all caught up with those. And I know, and that's been a few years ago now. That's a couple years out on some of these orders. And I know people get aggravated, but I promise you, if you were here, you would understand that I can't be in that shop long, and then I got to get to my real job. You know, if something else pops up with Rich and Tone, I got to stop what I do on the calls and get in there and, you know, get that. Cause that's our business is Rich and Tone. It's not Jay Stevens calls, but, And a lot of things come up during the day, I promise you. So I don't get near as much time as I would like to, but I enjoy both aspects of both RIT and the Jay Stevens line. So both really are a good relief to each other.
Yeah. Well, John, we're running up a little over an hour here. Can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time to share that story with us. It's very, very cool. Even for someone that's been aware of it and close to it for a while, it's cool to hear you tell this stuff. So we want to ask you, we try to do this with most of our guests. Sometimes we forget about it, but we have kind of a closing question. If you could change one thing about duck hunting, what would it be?
Ooh. Man, that's a tough one.
I'm just bringing it on you there so you don't have time to think about it.
Yeah, man, I don't know. You know, this is kind of going to go back on what I think we've talked about this whole show is, I wish when you, besides just getting a license, like Hunter's Ed, that you almost had to have a history class. Like you had to take a course to know about duck hunting, because I'm a big proponent on no matter what you do, if you know where you come from, you're a little more respectful, you got a little more knowledge, and a little more appreciation for it. And I think if we had something like that, you know, before you bought your license, I think that would solve a lot of problems on a lot of different levels. And that'd be a whole nother show getting into that. But, you know, I just think that the education part and knowing the history of it would make our sport even better. It's already one of the coolest, classiest hunting sports, in my opinion, there is, and has more heritage than any other sport. I just think that would be a cool thing to change. I guess it's not necessarily a change, but it would be something that would, I think, definitely add to it.
I think you're right. You know, the history piece is lost on a lot of people nowadays, and where that comes from, you know, whether it's good mentorship, bad mentorship, no mentorship, or getting into the game, maybe their dad didn't hunt or their granddad didn't hunt, so they got into the sport, which is great. Nothing wrong with it. We talk about here all the time. We actually need more hunters than we need less hunters. You know, but we need more hunters doing it the right way, and the right way is a pretty broad statement. I'm not trying to say you got to hunt like I do or anything like that, but that history piece would be huge. I mean, obviously the two of us, Casey and I, have a huge fascination with that, and come from a lot of the way we hunt nowadays has to deal with the way we were brought up and the way we see the sport based on those reflections backwards. So I think you're dead on about that. That'd be great if somebody had to write a book report on the history before they could go out and hunt.
Do y'all like how I kind of sidestepped that question? Because it almost stepped anybody's toes that might buy a duck call. So I wasn't going to say nothing too bad.
Yeah, that, well played. Well played. Well, John, we sure appreciate you coming on the show and taking a break on your Tuesday, because I know, you know, you could be out crappie fishing or something else, but before we get some goofy April weather, because it's pretty nice this week. But once again, thanks for coming on the show, and I hope we get to revisit on some of this stuff on down the road too when RNT does the next big cool thing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I appreciate y'all having me on, and I mean, anytime you can sit around and talk about duck hunting or duck calls, man, I'm always game. So feel free to holler at me anytime.
Yeah, for sure. And good luck with Collapalooza. I know that's, what'd you say, the end of May?
Yes, it's coming up quick.
Yeah, cool event. If you've never been, you might carve out a little time in your schedule to come to Stuttgart and see all that, because it's even grown. Back when the book came out, and I think I had a booth there, I think that was the first year. I think it was 2019, so it was the very first year, and it's grown exponentially since then. So highly recommend it.
Y'all should come set up and do some podcasts.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Good idea. Because, yeah, you got all kinds of people come in town for that.
Yeah, you can set up a lot of interviews, a lot of call makers and stuff.
Yeah. Well, all right, guys, that's another edition of The Standard Sportsman. We appreciate you tuning in. You can catch us online at www.thestandardsportsman.com and also on social media at The Standard Sportsman. We'll catch you next time.
Light boots, the lightest pair of knee boots you're ever going to find. Weighing in at just 13 ounces each. Putting on a pair of light boots is truly a jaw-dropping experience.